All right, fans, good to have you back with us. It is our weekly segment with Mark A. Simon Says of Sports Info Solutions. Always has a very interesting take on the game of baseball. Mark, how are you? How are things in your area?
We are surviving at this point. Just sitting back, watching some movies, watching some baseball from the past, and just waiting this thing out and hoping that the news starts to get a little bit better in the next couple of weeks.
One thing you are doing, and as I always tell people, they should follow you on Twitter. It's always interesting. Mark A. Simon Says, you're counting down the top 100 Met home runs. Is that, do I have that correct?
Yes, I am. I don't know how many people in San Francisco that will appeal to, but I can tell you that there are some Willie Mays. There's some Willie Mays stuff within this. I think if you're old enough to remember, you know that he homered in his first game for the Mets in New York against the Giants, and then homered in his first game against the Giants in San Francisco as well. And those were two pretty neat moments for him, certainly among his 660 home runs.
Well, Willie always said when he hit the home run in San Francisco, he almost went into the wrong dugout when he crossed home. Yeah, he tells that story that they had to sort of yell at him and push him back toward the Met dugout because he's so used to going into that dugout. What home run?
For the one that was hit in New York, he said that he almost kind of felt like bad rounding the bases because he could see the looks on their faces.
Yeah, well, it's an incredible trade for Charlie Williams way back in 72 for Willie to end up. But Horace Stoneham couldn't pay him, and Joan Payson loved him. And next thing you knew, he had a lifetime contract with Joan Payson and the Mets. That's why it happened. One of the home runs that I always had fun with, and I think I actually talked to Jimmy Pearsall about it, was Jimmy Pearsall's 100th home run that he hit. And he told Duke Snider, who hit his 400th, and Duke, when he hit his 400th, was sort of buried in, page 5 of the story. He said, "Duke, when I hit my 100th, I'm going to be on the front page." And he was right. Jimmy Pearsall was on the front page when he hit number 100, wasn't he?
Yeah, he ran the bases. Now, you have to be careful the way that you say it.
Yes.
He ran around the bases backwards. He didn't run the bases backwards, meaning he didn't go third, second, first, home.
Right.
He ran backwards around the bases as part of a goof. I actually was just reading about another home run that was hit where he was on base, and it was a walk-off home run where he slid into home plate to celebrate. So he had an interesting way about him. His life's certainly a very interesting one, documented in movies, went on to become a broadcaster as well.
Yeah, Fear Strikes Out was the movie. I met Jimmy Pearsall when he was with broadcasting for the White Sox, and I sat down with him, probably did about 20 minutes, 30 minutes of an interview with him. But after he hit that 100th home run and ran around the bases backwards, as Mark points out, Casey Stengel released him and said, "There's only room for one clown on this team, and it's me." And that was the end of Jimmy Pearsall. That was a great story.
Yeah, and I do want to give acknowledgement. Grant Brisby is doing the top 50 homers in San Francisco Giants history on The Athletic. He just started that. So for those that like the Mets, certainly check mine out. You can find it out at the link on Twitter. For Grant's, certainly check his out as well.
Yes, I saw that today. And in fact, I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to tell Raph, I said, we got to get Grant on. Because it would be a good segment. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought it up. All right. Well, all day long we've been playing Tim Lincecum highlights, the two no-hitters, the Brave game, which was awesome, maybe the best game he's ever pitched. Some of your thoughts about Tim Lincecum. And I know when you pick that sort of pitching chart apart, things have to jump out at you.
Yeah, and the Braves game, I think I've articulated this before when we were talking about his no-hitter, that the Braves game's my favorite of the, and I don't pretend to have seen, all of his starts, but of the ones that were certainly the marquee ones, the Braves one is my favorite. In that game, he got 30 missed swings. Now, you have a perspective on, what's a good strikeout game. He had 14. That's terrific. But 30 missed swings is like a number that you don't touch. In especially against a good team. We go back to 2004 with playoff data, and the only game with more than 25 other than Lincecum's is Gerrit Cole against the Rays last year. He had 31. Mm. 30 missed swings is a lot. That means that they missed on 8 of 9 against his changeup, and they missed on more than half of their swings against fastball. Again, to explain, put it in perspective, that doesn't happen. Guys hit the fastball. You might swing and miss on 10% of the swings you take against fastballs. Now they're missing at 50%. One other. So 14 Ks, 2 hits or fewer allowed. Playoffs, only been done 3 times ever in baseball. Kevin Brown, 98, Padres against the Astros. Clemens in 2000, Yankees against the Mariners, and the Lincecum game. And in Giants history, it's Lincecum, Bumgarner in 2016 against the Diamondbacks in the regular season, Kane in his perfect game, and Gaylord Perry, who you'll certainly know, 1966 against the Phillies.
Wow. Yeah, he's unbelievable. I love talking with him and with Bill Lasky and Ron Wotus. We had a great time talking about Lincecum and just what he accomplished. And I've said it a million times, of the whole crowd, he was the one guy. He's the one guy, and he was just such a natural kid that people just loved him. Just loved him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And, of course, the no-hitters, we've chatted about that a little bit on the show with you before, both against the Padres, which was unusual. And, of course, he was the first San Francisco Giant with multiple no-hitters. Christy Mathewson had done it for the old New York Giants. So, all right, but you know, as I said to you a million times, the eye test is one thing, but then when you get a number like 30 missed swings, that tells you you don't need the eye test at that point. You know, just tell me that, and that's enough for me. Oh, very good. That was a good insight into that. This week also was the birthday of Greg Maddux. And I started thinking about it, 54 years old. I know he did a very nice charitable thing with a multiple of 54 this week in Las Vegas where he lives. But Greg Maddux, 355 wins. August 7th of 2004 is when he got that 300th. And I started thinking about right-handed pitchers in the history of the game. And, of course, you get Cy Young up there at 5'11", and the game was so different at that point. But I said, let me ask Mark a little bit about, because you and I have never talked about Greg Maddux. So I said, let me ask Mark about Maddux and what you think of him. And it's an enormous amount of wins. In the history of the game, it's enormous. But what do you think about him as a pitcher? What jumps out at you?
All right, so a couple of things. One is the longevity aspect of it. 23 years, 740 starts, 5,000 innings. Those are numbers that are just not going to be touched these days. They're just not. They're ridiculous. The thing that I associate most with him visually is watching the ball come out of his hand and start to go to the outside corner and then kind of dart back just enough to where the catcher catches it like with half his glove around the plate and half his glove off the plate, and him always getting strikes on those pitches. And I think that it's important to point out that if we had pitch framing stats back then, we would have seen that Greg Maddux benefited from it a lot. Remember, he didn't like to throw to Javi Lopez. He liked to throw to whoever the backup was, because most
Eddie
of the
Perez.
Time for the Braves, backup was the really good pitch framer. Eddie Perez, Charlie O'Brien, Paul Bacco, I think, was another. He didn't like to throw to Javi Lopez. It's a shame that the 94 and 95 seasons didn't stretch all the way out, because those are among the two best pitching seasons of all time. When you put Maddux into a historical perspective, it's funny. He's eighth all-time among pitchers in wins above replacement. But what I think is funny about that is that if you stack the photos of the eight pitchers together, five of them are black and white. So in like modern times, he's one of the top 3-4 with Clemens, Seaver, guys of that ilk. And again, I think it's the longevity that does it for me, that he was so good for such an extended period of time. Essentially, taking it from the edges of my childhood up all the way into significant adulthood.
Yeah, interesting. Mark A. Simon says with us, Sports Info Solutions, you know, he didn't win a lot of championships and didn't have a lot of, you know, big postseason numbers, so to speak, and didn't have that explosive fastball like Clemens or Seaver or something like that. So that's what got me thinking about him. And then to hear you put him in the category of where he belongs with all the great right-handers of all time. I mean, he's probably, you know, Walter Johnson and Christy Mathewson and Grover Cleveland Alexander and Cy Young and him. It's probably it.
That's pretty good company. He's among the most elite of the elite. I did like what he did charity-wise. 54 for me, I added it up because I wanted to make a donation. I went with 35 wins against the Mets, 18 gold gloves because I work with defensive stats, so that's 53, and then number one in wins in my lifetime, which I go back to 1975. So I thought that was a good way to articulate 54 for Greg Maddux.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad we could touch on him. And, of course, any numbers? I don't know if you had a chance to go back and look at any numbers, swings and misses, or anything statistically that jumps out that you could share with us.
So you have to keep in mind with him that he didn't do it with the swing and miss. He averaged 6 strikeouts per 9 innings, which was on par, I guess, for guys in the mid-'80s, late-'80s, into the early 90s. I think it's the strikeout-to-walk ratio for him that is the stat that jumps off the page at you. I'm looking at the he had a 3-year run where it was 8-1, 6-1, 9-1. He led the National League in fewest walks per 9 innings 7 times. So I think I would put him with that. And then there's the stat. I'm trying to think of how to explain this right. It's called ERA Plus. It's on Baseball Reference, and it compares your ERA to the league ERA. And that way you could look over time, like I was this much better than the league ERA. And Greg Maddux had a 4-year run where he led in that every year, which is where kind of, as I said, the elite of the elite reside in that. And at his peak, he was way, 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 way better than the league ERA every year, a kind of pantheon that others can't really touch.
Oh, very good. I'm glad we did that. Again, he's one I don't want him to get lost in the shuffle at all. Great numbers. All right. This week we had a debut of Mickey Mantle, the anniversary of his debut with the New York Yankees. I know it's well before your time, and the Yankees not your favorite team. But say Mickey Mantle, what comes to your mind?
All right, so you said the debut, and I wanted to go back just to see how it was treated in the newspaper. This is our historical portion of the discussion here. He had a nice catch and an RBI single in his first game, which was Friday. So it would be, 69 years ago Friday. It's funny, in his first 12 games, he hit .222 with no home runs. Next 24 games, he hit .330 and it had an RBI a game. But the hype for him was so ridiculous. I'm reading sports writer Harry Grayson said the day of Mantle's debut, not even MacArthur's firing, Douglas MacArthur had just gotten fired, comes close to the Mantle story. And I guess I think of he was the super hyped player of his time, one of certainly a few. And he's one of the ones that lived up to it, although I suppose we think that he could have lived to an even greater height with it. But the numbers are great for him. The Triple Crown season, so many league-leading type things. It's a shame, his post-baseball life a bit, but on the field, the guy was as good as it gets.
Well, he said if he would have known that the numbers meant so much, he wouldn't have drank as much. And so he would have been a different kind of player, but an icon. And that's still number 7, so a very special spot. And then you put him together with Yogi and the surrounding cast. So you can never forget the Yankees' surrounding cast, whether it was pitchers who would be there for a year or two, or the Whitey Fords of the world, or Bill Scourin and Richardson and Kubek and Hank Bauer and Woodling. But Mickey, and Yogi. That was the core of those great championship teams.
Yeah, Yogi Berra, by the way, top four in the MVP 7 years in a row. That's like Bonds territory there. I mean, it's not quite Bonds, but for a catcher, that's pretty ridiculous to go top four MVP 7 years in a row.
Amazing. Yeah, that's another one where, you know, you have to hear that. You knew Yogi, you know, he's a Hall of Famer and all the Yogi-isms and the things he would say. But when you put that in perspective of what kind of a ball player he was, Casey Stengel always said it. He said, that's the guy, number eight. He's the guy that makes this team. It wasn't Mantle, it was Berra. And Berra, as we've talked on the show tonight, Berra is someone who played 150 games a year. And, you know, Charlie Silvera was his backup and got 40 at-bats a year for 8 years. that was all that happened. All right, I'm glad we could touch on those two. A couple of light questions for you.
Sure.
I know baseball, we miss it very much, and we think about all the things we miss. And this was out on Twitter this week, and I must commend the people on Twitter coming up with good questions. So of all the things that you miss about baseball, was there one that sort of surprised you? You said, boy, I miss this too. What would that be?
Yeah. So I go in a good year in the stands, I probably go to 8 to 10 games. In my younger times, I probably went to about 15 a year where I'd go sit in the stands with my dad. And I guess the thing that I miss from thinking about that, like, all the obvious things, but I guess the other would be when you sit in a number of different places in New York, Shea Stadium or Citi Field, having someone stand up in front of you at what's about to be an important time in the game and yelling at them, down in front, that's something I wish I could be doing right about now, but not today.
That's a good one. Yeah, I like that because it always happens in the ninth inning with two out.
Yes.
And then you could have bases loaded and a very dramatic moment, and you want to just sit and let it unfold, and everyone stands up. And I've been through that. I understand what you mean. All right, let me give you another one. Of course, we see a lot of baseball movies now. They repeat them a lot, but some I hadn't seen in years. And I'm going to ask you, I'm going to give you four movies. You give me your favorite. Bull Durham, okay. Major League, The Natural, or Field of Dreams?
Okay, I'm glad you picked four that I've seen. Of those four, I think I like Field of Dreams the best. It's been a long, probably been 25, 30 years since I've seen The Natural. Maybe, given how many times it's been on MLB Network, I keep skipping it. I like Bull Durham a lot.
Week,
yeah, I like Bull Durham a lot. But I think I liked Field of Dreams, and I saw it when it came out at the very beginning. And I remember being like, wow, this is just a well-done movie, start to finish. Costner's good in just about any baseball movie. And I think that I would put that at the top. I actually, just to give you an indication of what I was watching before I talked to you, I had the Maltese Falcon on before I was chatting up with you.
Yeah, we got that on tonight. Casablanca is is on it. Said, oh, yeah, we got this is a noir film noir. It's Saturday night, and Eddie Muller's got about three of them on TCM tonight. So I love them.
Nice.
I love them. That's another story. Well, great having you on. For me, it was Bull Durham, and I hadn't seen it in so many years, and I really watched it carefully. And I said, boy, this is, you know, and there's, of course, a silly part of it, but there's a part of this movie that is really the minor leagues. I mean, really the minor leagues.
And they took it seriously in the making of it. Definitely.
Yeah, they did. And I met the original Crash Davis and Ronnie Howard when he named, of course, Kevin Costner's name in the movie is Crash Davis, a real person. And he went to the phone book in Durham, North Carolina, and looked down in the phone book and looked at different names and players and all this, and he came up with Crash Davis. And Crash Davis was a real person who played for the Philadelphia A's, and I got to meet him and talk to him. And he was a lovely man. That's the Crash Davis that they used in the movie.
One of the funny things, Bull Durham's on as we're talking.
See? It's all meant to be. It all makes sense. Hey, Mark, great to have you on as always. Be safe all week and look forward to talking to you next week when we talk some more baseball with you.
You got it.
All right. Thank you. That is Mark A. Simon Says. By the way, next week our show starts at 7 p.m. Pacific. 7 p.m. Pacific for our show next week. All right. More coming up. KBR 680, 104.5, The Sports Leader.